According to the latest economic figures from the government, Americans are showing signs of some financial smarts in the midst of a very slow-growth economy, where consumer debt is near an all-time peak. Consumer savings in March went from 5.6% to 5.9%. At the same time, consumer borrowing reached $12.7 trillion in the first 3 months of 2017. Rising savings is definitely a good sign, but rising debt can also be a good sign. People are buying more. But if it reflects ballooning student loans and just high-interest credit card debt, that could put brakes on the economy. The choice between savings and debt in individual households tells the story of consumers' persistent struggles, stories that some of you are anxious to share.
This is Emily Lattimore in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. We learned to live with the reality of credit card debt, which we were both able to avoid for most of our adult lives. But now, with two kids, two cars, a home that always seems to need some sort of maintenance, it's a matter of managing debt as opposed to escaping it anymore.
This is Harold Vickers calling from Port Orchard, Washington. Yeah, we've taken on some debt, but it's planned debt. So we're doing some major home renovations, and our plan is to work together to pay that debt off, and we're looking at a two-year payoff. So I don't think debt is always detrimental, just how you use it.
Hi, my name is Mac from Portland, Oregon. We are in debt. We have a lot of expenses we don't need, like internet and TV, and that's compounded by the huge cost of our necessaries going up, like healthcare, property taxes, and food that's not from a box. With two kids, as a couple, we need to make about $4,000 a month just to make ends meet and have even a small cushion.
Matt from Portland, Oregon, sounds like he's confessing a little bit. Well, debt is a serious problem, and Ebony Brown comes from Elgin, Illinois, outside of Chicago. She grew up poor in Gary, Indiana, and she takes us much deeper into how she's had to learn to keep her head above water.
When I was growing up, you know, our family was very particular with just going to work and just making ends meet. So there was no conversation around the dinner table about savings or about purchasing a home or budgeting, any of those things that really are necessary to secure a strong financial future. So what I'm doing now is just what I just mentioned, all of that. You know, I have a budget. You know, we stick to it. You know, you have to have your emergency fund savings. You have to do planning for your children's future. You have to plan for retirement. So there's a couple of things and strategies that I've implemented to help me with that along the way. But first, very early on when I was first out of college, you know, I fell into that same pool with my parents of really not knowing how to manage money. And I think that I just got tired of not being able to enjoy life and to not see myself grow. And I think I had to just change that.
Well, you're tired of the stress is what you're saying, right?
Right. The stress of it all. Right. The stress of not knowing if you'll ever come out of being able to have savings set aside. The stress of not knowing if you're going to live paycheck to paycheck or, you know, the budgeting of do I have enough money just to do everyday things such as get groceries and get gas and pay bills. And you have to make changes in order to accommodate and overcome that.
Most people are raised with the idea that you don't talk about money. Is money being a secret a problem in a family where maybe everybody doesn't know the numbers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that money needs to be an open communication. I think that children need to be taught from a very early age how to budget, how to manage. Myself, I have three children. One is an infant, but the other two are 5 and 7. And they have a chore board and they earn an allowance. And when I give them their allowance, I make them pay me a dollar back for taxes because that's something that they have to get used to. Something that has to become a part of their everyday knowledge and vocabulary as they get older. We talk about savings, and then we talk about spending. And we talk about whether it's important to spend your money on things or spend your money on experiences or save it for something better at a later date.
Ebony, is your husband on your team with all this, or does sometimes he fall off the wagon?
You know, I think that I've gotten my husband on the wagon. He might still be trailing a little bit further behind me. But we had a lot of struggles in first getting married. I'll just be very open. My husband had a lot of debt, and I didn't learn that until just before we got married. So imagine, you know, 5 months before a wedding, you're realizing, oh, underneath the bed, there's a box full of bills that, you know, I'm struggling with and don't know how to manage and pay. So it's taken some time. I think that he understands my point of view now. He admits that he does not like the coupons and the time that it takes at checkout, but he appreciates it and he understands how it helps us to get ahead. You know, the world is going to keep changing. The world is going to keep moving forward. And if you are not there with it and you're not on that uptrend with it, then you're going to very well get pushed and left behind. So you have to understand how to manage money, how to budget, and how to keep up with how the world is changing in order to stay afloat.
You've got an MBA in household economics, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's all from my own struggles for myself and really a lot of late night Susie Orman talk shows that really kind of changed my financial position.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You got to admire Ebony Brown there. She lives with her husband and three children in Elgin, Illinois, sharing all those stories with us. And it's not just Ebony Brown. Little Rock, Arkansas, my debt is mostly medical and dental bills for procedures I needed to have. I also relied on credit cards when I lost my job. From Kirkwood, Missouri, I have about $27,000 in student loan debt, about $140,000 for my mortgage for a house I bought in order to help take care of some relatives, $10,000 in credit cards, and $15,000 in car repayment. Denver, Colorado. My debt is student loans. I took on loans because I refused to be uneducated just because of money. Socioeconomic status should not keep people from knowledge. And it sounds like you're learning a bunch of knowledge about money as well there in Denver. These personal financial stories are kind of irresistible. I mean, we could read them for the rest of the hour. I mean, I could read them for another hour, for that matter. They're kind of a deep MRI-like picture of the U.S. economy. And what they show is not people trying to get rich, but just seeking something more modest. Rachel Schneider is a senior vice president at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. She undertook an in-depth study with New York University professor Jonathan Mordock, where they spoke with 235 low- and middle-income families over a year as they handled their finances. And what they found is that families are seeking modest goals and basic stability. Their findings can be seen in the book The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And I would recommend the book just for morale boosting, if nothing else. And their research shows simple stability is as elusive for many families as that jackpot at the end of the rainbow.
We tell the story of a family in the book who earns right around the median income of U.S. households. And nonetheless, when we ask them, what's your major financial goal? The wife in the family who works full-time and her husband works full-time and they both take on part-time jobs too to make ends meet, she still says her main financial goal is to be able to pay all her bills on time and in full, which is shocking, right? So she's describing this constant game of whack-a-mole. She's behind on something, catching up on something else. And it's not for a lack of effort. She spends a lot of time thinking about her money too.
And as a broad question of, you know, Americans feeling like they're doing better than their parents, you know, the kinds of things that we talk about in politics a lot, is there hope? Can you get ahead? Are you on a trend line that's upward? What do you think this means for people to be in a kind of survival state pretty much their whole lives?
Well, you know, you can still get ahead, but it feels more like the unusual story. And maybe that's always been the case, right? Maybe this has just been our national myth. I think it really feels unfair to people, and it fuels a lot of anger.
And that sense of feeling desperate all the time is just, you know, something that people resent because that's not the way it should be.
Yeah, exactly. And it feels like, you know, if you're working full time, you're paying your bills on time, your kids are going to school, you're involved in your community, then shouldn't you have some level of ease, some level of confidence and security? So Sarah is worried that eventually they'll lose their home, right? Because she is occasionally behind on her mortgage in this ongoing game of which bill to pay and which bill not to pay. And that feels wrong. It feels unfair.
Is it bipartisan? In other words, people of every political orientation are having the same kind of experience?
You know, we were doing this research prior to the election, and so we actually didn't ask questions about political orientation or who you voted for. And I have to say, this has been the major question everyone has asked us now, right, as we talk about the work. Who did the people in the Financial Diaries vote for? And I just don't know. But I will say our study was conducted in New York, Mississippi, along the border in Ohio and Kentucky, and in California. You know, and so we were capturing urban and rural families, immigrant and native-born families. And it's not that we saw something dramatically different in any of those places, which is really more a function of how our economy has changed than anything else.
There's an argument that, okay, Americans have had it so good that they're all spoiled, and of course they don't have any financial skills because they're used to racking up credit card bills, and they see all the ads on TV that entitle them to big screen TVs and new cars all the time. And of course they're in this situation. How do we get out of it?
You know, that narrative always troubles me because that's not what we saw from families, right? We didn't see dramatic overspending. What we saw was people who work full time but nonetheless have very unsteady or volatile incomes. So we have to focus not only on how much people earn but how does that money come into the household. And the increasingly, whether you work in the gig economy or not, people have lots of ups and downs in their earnings. Combine that with the fact that wages have been stagnant for decades, but the cost of living has gone up dramatically, right? The cost of education, healthcare, transportation, housing, they've all gone up. And so we're asking families to do something far more complicated than they used to have to do in terms of making a stable financial life out of what is inherently highly chaotic.
Is this sustainable? Did you get a sense of it can't go on like this?
I don't think it's sustainable. Absolutely not. Because what we're experiencing is that our social safety net hasn't caught up to the way work functions today. So the old model of you'll work for the same company for your, you know, the majority of your life. And over that time, you'll get promoted and you'll earn more next year than you earned last year. And during that time, you'll pay down your mortgage. And so by the time you get to retirement, you'll have this nice nest egg. You'll be able to live in the house you've now paid off. That model doesn't exist for most workers now. Now most workers have multiple jobs over the course of their lives. Their incomes don't necessarily steadily rise as they move from job to job. And yet our expectations about how people would save for retirement really haven't caught up with that.
And so a President Obama preaching, we're going to have, you know, jobs for solar installers and the green economy is going to come in here and produce thousands and thousands of jobs. Or the Trump narrative, which is, I'm going to bring these corporations back. Neither of them speak to reality. They're both a kind of mythology that Americans can't actually take advantage of.
I think that's true. The issue is that we have to think about not only whether or not people are employed, but how that work is structured and what kinds of benefits that work delivers. So manufacturing jobs aren't inherently good jobs. They're good jobs because people unionized, the government supported people in unionizing, and then workers collectively negotiated for a whole set of benefits. So what we need to think about now is not only, you know, do we get solar jobs or bring manufacturing back to the U.S., but in the jobs that our economy is creating, which, you know, are predominantly service sector jobs, retail jobs, home healthcare jobs, are workers getting a fair deal? Are they getting benefits? Are they getting secure employment? Are they having opportunities for advancement? Do they have control over their schedule and some paid time off? You can deliver that through any kind of job in the economy. It requires making a decision as a society that we're going to value work in a deep way.
Rachel Schneider is co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. She's also Senior Vice President at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.